Robert Lustig, MD, is a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at University of California, San Francisco, and director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program at UCSF. Dr. Lustig graduated from MIT in 1976 and has received his MD from Cornell University Medical College in 1980. He completed his pediatric residency at St. Louis Children's Hospital in 1983 and clinical fellowship at UCSF in 1984. From there, he spent 6 years as a postdoctorate fellow and research associate in neuroendocrinology at the Rockefeller University. He has been a faculty member at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the University of Tennessee, Memphis. Dr. Lustig has authored 85 reviewed, peer-reviewed articles and 30 reviews. Dr. Lustig is the co-author of Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. The book's available this evening. And the Fat Chance Cookbook. And we also have one of the co-authors of, where did you go? There you are, of the recipes in the audience tonight. Dr. Lustig is also very well known for his rather phenomenal YouTube video about high fructose corn syrup. So if you haven't seen that, you should. Just Google him on YouTube, high fructose corn syrup, and there he is. It's 80 minutes, well worth your watching. He's also the founder and president of the board of directors of the nonprofit Institute for Responsible Nutrition, whose sole mission is to reverse childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Robert Lustig.
Thank you all for coming. If any of you have ever heard me talk before, one of the things that distinguishes my talks is the science. You know, I got here on the science. The science is my sword and my shield. And I am absolutely stepping out from behind the science tonight, in part because of some things that have happened over the past couple of years. And so this talk is going to be grounded in science, but a whole lot more political. And I hope it won't be a rant. I don't plan on it being a rant. But when you see what's going on, you may get just as upset as I have. And that's part of the issue. In order to get people to change, you have to get them to change cognitively, and you also have to get them to change viscerally. You have to provide both at the same time. And I'm hoping that this talk will do just that. So with that, I want to thank a lot of my colleagues that are in the audience, in particular Wolfram Alderson, who is our president, executive director of our Institute for Responsible Nutrition, Cindy Gershon, who is the co-author of our Fat Chance cookbook, Kristen Carnes, who is a postdoctoral fellow at Clinical Translational Sciences Institute at UCSF, and is working on the sugar documents, as you will hear. So I have no disclosures, no food industry concern is putting me up to this, I promise you. I'm going to be borrowing information during the course of the talk from several sources to weave this together for you. The first is this book that came out in February of this year by Nicholas Freudenberg, who's a sociologist at City University of New York, called Lethal But Legal. And in it, he talks about the tactics of six separate industries: food, pharma, tobacco, guns, automotive, and energy. I'm going to limit my discussion tonight to food because that's the area I know best. But there are certain, similarities and paradigms that go on with all of these in terms of what's going on in our society today. This just came out 2 days ago. It is from the Union of Concerned Scientists, of which I am a member, called Added Sugar, Subtracted Science. And it talks about sugar, high fructose corn syrup, and sweeteners. My book, Fat Chance, which will talk about processed food and also the Congress, FDA, USDA, and the White House. And most recently, if you've not heard about it, the movie Fed Up, which is playing at the Landmark Embarcadero right at the Ferry Building. And it is well worth your 90 minutes and your $10, I promise you. You will not be upset or sorry. All right. First of all, let's back up. Here's the past. A whole 13 years ago, 2001, 6 million kids are seriously overweight. Indeed. Well, here we are, 13 years later, with all of the media attention, with all of the clinical programs, with all of the NIH funding, with Michelle Obama's vegetable gardens, we are now at 20 million. Here's the present. Currently, there are 30% more obese people on the planet than there are undernourished people. 15 years ago was exactly the opposite. Now, all of these countries did not all of a sudden just decide not to diet and exercise. Something else is going on here. And this is going on in countries that never had obesity before, like Mexico. 371 million diabetics walking the earth. That's 7% of the world's population. And they are chewing through all the healthcare resources. And there's no money for anything else. So much so that the UN Secretary General has declared that non-communicable disease, that is, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, cancer, are now a bigger threat to the developing world than the developed world. And this means a reallocation of resources. Currently, insurance costs $2,751 per employee for obesity-related disease, whether the employee is obese or not. This is leading to declines in productivity worldwide. And I just spent 2 weeks ago, I was in the Netherlands and Paris talking with banks about this issue in terms of sustainability and productivity. And here's what happens if we do nothing. This is the future. Experts predict 165 million Americans will be obese by the year 2030. That's 42% of the U.S. population. And 100 million Americans will have diabetes by 2050. That will be one-third of the U.S. population. And there's no money to go around. But it really doesn't matter because Medicare will be broke by the year 2026. And the thing that really sets this off for me is that I'm going to be 69 in the year 2026. And I worked really hard, and I want my friggin' Medicare. Okay? And so should you. So the question is, what's going on? So this is where the politics come in. So here's a quiz. Who was the most dangerous person in the 20th century? Easy answer. Nope. No. Way more dangerous than that. Adolf Hitler. Okay, but now, here's the second question. Who was the second most dangerous person of the 20th century? What do you think? Getting close. Who? Nope. Somebody you'd never expect. Ronald McDonald. Pretty close. Judge Lewis Powell. Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Okay? How could that be? Think about it. Well, here's his bio right here. In World War II, he was a member of counterintelligence, and he really believed in the need for government secrecy. This was a guy who never let anything off his desk. He was a partner for 25 years in a law firm in Virginia and was actually chairman of the Richmond School Board, and it defied Brown versus Board of Education. So that's where Lewis Powell lived. He advocated constant surveillance of textbook and television content. He actually advocated book burning. And he was the contact point for the tobacco industry, especially with Virginia Commonwealth University, because after all, they gave a lot of money back then in Virginia. From 1964 to 1971, he was a board member of Philip Morris. He never represented humans. He only represented corporations. He was in mergers and acquisitions. He represented the Tobacco Institute. He named Ralph Nader as the chief antagonist of American business. And he was never a judge or a constitutional lawyer. He only used the law to advance a corporate agenda, his agenda. Yet, he ended up on the Supreme Court. Nixon appointed him, and I'll show you his track record during his Supreme Court years. This was a period of time that was kind of an interesting time in America, as you know, the 1960s, leading up into the 1970s. For those of you who don't remember, it was kind of a funky time. In fact, there have been waves of corporate versus individual rights that have gone on over the course of the past 100 years. And here there's a listing of them. So the corporate rights are in blue, and the individual rights decades are in orange. And you can see that in the 1980s, we had the robber barons who were trying to basically gouge prices and make big fortunes for themselves, like Carnegie and Rockefeller and people like that. In the 1900s, we had Teddy Roosevelt battling against them. the beginning of unions to try to battle that wave. In the 1920s, it went back again with Teapot Dome and the rollback of regulations under Garfield, and that culminated in the Depression. In the same way, we had a problem in 2008 because of largesse of corporations. It was the same thing that drove the Depression back in the 1920s. So the response to that in the 1930s was FDR, the WPA, the New Deal, the creation of the Securities Exchange Commission. That was, again, for individual rights. In the 1940s to 50s, we had World War II and communism. We had the rollback of individual rights again because we were all concerned about the Red Scare. And then in the 1960s, individual rights came back again with the publication of Silent Spring, about insecticides and what that was doing in DDT with Rachel Carson. Civil rights, of course, consumer protection became an issue. Seatbelts during that time, and of course, Ralph Nader, who, you know, unsafe at any speed. So this was what was going on, and this is what Lewis Powell was railing against, was that 1960s. And in 1971, he wrote a very famous missive known as the Powell Memorandum. And he wrote it to the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Eugene Sidner. And what he did was he bemoaned the loss of America's standing in the world. He thought that somehow America had gone wrong back in the 1960s with all of the unrest and with all the political upheaval that occurred during the 1960s. And he argued that corporations had to take back America, that only corporations could deal with the problems of America. And it was because of individual consumers and individual rights that we had lost our way. And that corporate America had to become more aggressive in molding politics. He argued that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce had to become politically active. And this sparked several right-wing organizations, such as the Heritage Foundation and the American Legislative Exchange Council, which today provides campaign contributions to 338 out of 535 congresspeople. In 1974, Jack Anderson, the muckraking columnist for the Washington Post, whom I met because I took a journalism course in high school, exposed the Powell Memorandum for what it was, but by that time he was already on the Supreme Court and he was set for life. So here's Powell's agenda on the Supreme Court. These were his rulings. So in 1971, he was appointed. In 1974, U.S. v. Nixon, he believed in government secrecy and didn't want anything out. In 1976, the Virginia State Pharmacy Board versus Virginia Citizens Consumer Council, that allowed unfettered corporate advertising. That was the start of the drug company direct marketing to consumers. Was that. In 1976, Buckley v. Valeo did away with limitations on campaign expenditures, and that allowed private spending in elections, and that led to Citizens United and McCutcheon, which are the most recent versions of that, which basically they said corporations are now people. They weren't before, but now they are. First National Bank of Boston v. Bilotti overturned a law that restricted corporate contributions to campaigns. So now anybody could give any amount of money. And finally, in 1980, Central Hudson, which was the free speech, the corporate commercial speech issue that allows corporations to basically say whatever they want, whenever they want, and government has nothing to say about it. That was Central Hudson. And I will show you Central Hudson later on. This is because I went to law school. This is what going to law school gets you. All right? So the 1980s saw Powell's doctrine, if you will, a different Powell doctrine, into practice. Risk arbitrage, values of companies became very volatile, as you remember, buying and selling of companies, you know, just to turn a profit and then selling them back again. Mass media being controlled by one person because changes were made in the FCC law that allowed Rupert Murdoch, for instance, to be able to amass the corporate media empire that he was able to do. That was a violation of the Sherman Act, but it went by the boards. Reduction in union strength during this time, public relations, advertising, and lobbying everywhere. And I'll show you, here's the data right here. Buckley v. Vallejo ushered this in. Lobbyists went from 175 to 2,500 in 5 years. And packs, there were 300, now there were 1,200 in 5 years because of Buckley v. Vallejo. And this was Lewis Powell's doing. So the 1980s brought a bunch of different corporate agendas to the fore. First one was short-termism, that is the buying and selling of companies, this whole concept of risk arbitrage. Turn a quick profit, turn it around. For instance, Philip Morris buying Kraft and then unloading it, as an example. Financialization. So KKR, Henry Kravis, bought RJR Nabisco with leveraged debt, but he had to turn a profit quickly. So whatever you can do to sell. So that was the origin of Snackwells, and they're still with us today. 2 grams of fat down, 13 grams of carbohydrate up. The question, of course, is, was that a good trade? And we'll talk about that a little bit later on as well. Privatization, a transfer of services from the public to the private sector. For instance, up till recently, the FDA had this thing called generally recognized as safe. Now, it was pretty easy to get onto that list, but the list started with 170 items. Do you know how many there are today? 10,000 items are on the FDA's grass list. Now, do you really think there are 10,000 things we can eat that won't hurt us? And in fact, of those 10,000, the FDA doesn't even know about 1,000 of them. All you have to do to get onto the list is convene a meeting and say, it's grass. That's it. As of 1997. So this is, you know, privatization of governmental actions. Tax relief. This was my favorite. So you get to deduct performance pay for CEOs from your taxes. So there are two-thirds of American companies who pay no federal income tax from 1998 to 2005. So Yum Brands, the CEO made $94 million in performance pay, and that lowered the IRS bill by $33 million, and they didn't pay taxes. Now, are you okay with that? I'm sure not okay with that. And the problem is that by doing so, you're depriving the government of the money that's necessary to institute regulations. So how easy is it to keep the regulations in place when there's no money in the government to be able to do it, and we're now operating at the deficit that we are, and we can't even make it up? How many trillions of dollars we are now in deficit because they're not paying for it, because they get to deduct their performance pay from the IRS. Deregulation. So removing the regulations that were in place to protect people. For instance, in 1984, the FCC repealed all restrictions on marketing to children. In 1994, something that happened in the food world called DSHEA, it was the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act. This spawned the $121 billion nutraceuticals industry. You do not have to prove that a nutraceutical works. The government has to prove that a nutraceutical will hurt you in order to get rid of it. And there's no money to do so. So all nutraceuticals are okay because of DSHEA. Question is that okay? Allows direct marketing. You're on your own. You get to decide whether or not a marketing ploy is real or not, except for one little problem. Eight-year-olds don't even know the difference between advertising and the TV show. And they're being marketed to lock, stock, and barrel, and there are no restrictions. And market concentration. This is what happens when you have deregulation. More companies compete initially, which sounds good from the standpoint of competition and, you know, American enterprise. The problem is most of them end up folding. They end up coalescing. Look what happened to the airlines. Can you name one industry that has benefited from deregulation? One, even one, they all go down the tubes. And the reason is because fewer people are making more money rather than more people making less money. That's what happens to deregulation. It's supposed to spawn competition, but it does the exact opposite over time. And it turns out that because of deregulation, 10 food conglomerates control 90% of the world's food supply. And here they are, right here. Kraft, Coke, Pepsi, General Mills, Kellogg's, Mars, Unilever, J&J, P&G, and Nestle. 90% of the world's food in the hands of 10 companies, 10 for-profit companies. Okay, so who was the third most dangerous person of the 20th century? Huh? No, I'm not even going to talk about Ansel Keys. This guy right here, Dr. Evil. And I didn't call him that. 60 Minutes called him that. His name is Rick Berman. Rick Berman. And who is Rick Berman? He is a Washington lawyer who runs a PR firm. He is the founder of a group called Center for Consumer Freedom. Anybody heard of that? You think they're really interested in your freedom? Okay. He is the attack dog against the nanny state. So anytime you ever hear the term nanny state, that's Rick Berman. That's his mantra. He is the chief steward of the doctrine of personal responsibility. So whenever you hear somebody say, this is your choice, that's Rick Berman. That's what they do. And so the ultimate is, if you're obese, it's your fault because you had the choice. That's where it comes down. And I have a real problem with that because I'm a pediatrician and I take care of all of these obese six-month-olds. And they don't diet and exercise. Okay, so how did they get obese? Is it their fault? Well, Rick Berman would say, well, of course it's their fault. Well, I have a real problem with that. And that's what got me here. And I have a real problem with Center for Consumer Freedom because they put this out. This is a vision of Lustig's world, and they have a cartoon of, it says, ice cream, we ID no one under the age of 18. But I'm really, really ticked because this was in March of 2012 they published this, but the cartoon is from 2004. They couldn't even come up with a new one for me. That really irked me. I want a new one. All right, the point is that there's been a lot of propagandizing the public. And I want you to get a little bit angry as we talk about this. So, the question of personal responsibility. Everyone has a choice. This is America, right? This is, you know, embedded in our DNA. This, you know, was there at the beginning of, you know, the revolution. You know, that's why we fought the revolution, was to have personal choice, right? Wrong. Not true. Well, if you get sick, it's your fault. The question is, where did this come from? Where did this concept of personal responsibility come from if it was not there at the Declaration of Independence? I'll tell you where. It came from Big Tobacco. Tobacco invented this. Back in 1963, they were taking it on the chin because of lung cancer before the Surgeon General's report of 64. And so they invented personal responsibility and said, well, you get to choose whether you smoke or not. You know, we're just supplying the product. You get to choose. Well, you know, if it's addictive, you don't get to choose. And that's the point. And they spent 30 years denying the addictive nature. And we ultimately caught them in the corporate malfeasance that went on. You have a choice to smoke, they said, but if a substance is addictive, do you really? That's the whole point of addiction. You know it's bad for you, you know it's ruining your life, and you can't do anything about it anyway. So this centers around the concept of what does addiction mean, and does that mean anything for personal responsibility, especially if you don't know you're consuming it. So this is where this concept comes in. This is sort of the corollary to personal responsibility. This is from Coca-Cola's Coming Together campaign of last year. And this is directly right from their TV commercial, which you probably all saw. Beating obesity will take action by all of us based on one simple common sense fact. All calories count, no matter where they come from, including Coca-Cola and everything else with calories. In other words, you can get your calories from carrots, or you can get your calories from cheesecake, or you can get your calories from Coca-Cola. It doesn't matter because a calorie is a calorie. If you eat more than you burn, you'll gain weight. If you eat less than you burn, you will lose weight. Therefore, if you're fat, it's your fault. Don't blame us. This is a great way to absolve oneself of responsibility because now it's all your responsibility. Well, I don't believe in common sense. I believe in data. I believe in science. That's where I live. And the science says something else. Let's talk about that. So here's what they're basing this concept on. They're basing it on this thing called the first law of thermodynamics, which says that the total energy inside a closed system remains constant, which is a law. I subscribe to the first law. If I didn't, you'd run me out of here on a rail and call me a zealot, heretic, and whatever else. Okay? But there are two interpretations of that law, like any law. It's subject to interpretation, like the Supreme Court. Okay? Here are the two interpretations. Here's the first one, the standard one, the one you believe, the one you've been taught, the one I used to believe. If you eat it, you better burn it, or you're going to store it. Now, who here believes that? Come on, come on, come on. Yeah, right. Okay. That comes from a calorie is a calorie. That's where that comes from. Energy balance. Energy balance. That's their term, energy balance. That's the food industry's term, energy balance. That's not any doctor's term. That's the food industry's term. Okay. And if that's true, well, the calories in, that's gluttony. And the calories out, that's sloth, gluttony and sloth. Oh, obesity is the result of two aberrant behaviors. It's your fault if you believe this interpretation of the first law. But I don't. So here's the dogma. Calorie is a calorie. Free will. You get to choose. Gluttony and sloth, diet and exercise. Why pick on any food? Any food can be part of a balanced diet. This is what every dietitian who belongs to the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics will tell you. Any food can be part of a balanced diet. Question is that true? Well, if it's personal responsibility, if a calorie is a calorie, then it's all true. The question is it? So are we just in the midst of a caloric bacchanal? Wait, oh, this isn't right. Hold on, that's much better. Okay. Now, we are all eating more. I don't argue that. Of course we're eating more. You can't get fat if you're not eating more. Of course we're eating more. 187 calories a day more for adult men, 335 calories a day more for adult women, 275 calories a day more for teen boys in the last 25 years. We're all eating more. The question is, why are we all eating more? How come we weren't eating more before? People say, well, the food's there. You know what? It was there before. And we didn't do that. Something else has happened. And not only has it happened here, it's happened there. It's happened everywhere. It's happened in every country because every country has seen an uptick in obesity. Sri Lanka has an uptick in obesity. All right? So could it really be just about gluttony and sloth? These people don't even have a pot to piss in and they've got obesity. So you'd say, well, here's the problem. Evolution of fast food, you know. So over here on the left is the original White Castle hamburger of 210 calories. And there, over there is Bob's Big Boy in the middle at 6 ounces at 618. And in the midst of this obesity pandemic, Hardee's had the temerity to offer us the thick burger at 1,420 calories. Okay. And, of course, we have the Carl's Jr. $6 burger. It wouldn't even fit on the slide at 2,000 calories. And, of course, that's the whole, you know, caloric requirement for the whole day. And it's in one hamburger. So you say, well, there's your answer, right? Not so fast. How about this? Anybody had a Trenta? What do you think? Trenta? 916 cc's. The stomach only holds 900 cc's. It's bigger than your stomach. And you know that it's not coffee. It's a coffee-related frozen drink with sugar, right? You can't get black coffee in a Trenta. They don't make that. Okay. How about this? This is my favorite. Has the food gotten so cheap now that we're giving it away? Free double-licious chicken sandwich with a purchase of a 30-ounce drink. That's how cheap the food is now. Or is it the opposite side of the equation? Do we have just an activity famine? Okay, all of a sudden, everyone has stopped exercising all at once. So you can see here on this slide the decline in the amount of physical activity for white and black girls. And by the age 15 to 16, I mean, black girls are basically just lying on the floor. They're not moving at all, according to this. So you say, well, gee, there's your obesity epidemic right there. So you could say, well, these are behaviors. This is gluttony and sloth. Personal responsibility. Well, I would challenge that. There are six reasons to doubt this formulation. First, no child chooses to be obese. The quality of life of an obese child is the same as a child on cancer chemotherapy. I take care of these kids, and there's not one kid who walks in and says, gee, I think I'll be obese today. Okay? This is the worst thing that has ever happened to them. This affects their social relationships. This affects virtually every aspect of their lives, and they do not want this. Nobody wants to be obese. Number two, do diets work? Every diet works for about 2 months, and then they stop working. So then the number of people who can actually maintain their weight loss after the 2 months is vanishingly small, less than 1% of the population. So the question is, why? Turns out, people start a diet for 2 months, and then 3 months later, they're not on the diet. So Christopher Gardner's A to Z study down at Stanford shows that nobody is on the diet after 2 months because nobody can deal with the changed food environment given our current food environment for that long. That's what every diet regresses to the mean, and so every weight regresses back to the baseline. That's what happens. How about exercise? Does exercise work? All the doctors say, well, if you'd only exercise, you'd lose weight. Well, you know what? There is not one study in the entire medical literature anywhere in any country that shows that exercise alone promotes weight loss. Not one. Why is exercise so important then if it doesn't promote weight loss? It promotes muscle gain. And muscle weighs more than fat, so it actually makes you gain weight. But it's muscle weight. You lose inches around your middle, but you actually weigh more on the scale. And those muscles have mitochondria, and those mitochondria burn the energy instead of it all going to your liver, where it's going to make your liver sick. So exercise is the single best thing you can do for yourself, no question, and I am a big fan of it, but not because it causes weight loss. So if it doesn't cause weight loss, then that whole calories in, calories out thing doesn't make sense, does it? Number three, this isn't just about America. This isn't just about the UK. It's not just about Australia. This is going on everywhere. Canada, Japan, Korea, India, Thailand, everywhere. Doesn't matter. Everywhere has seen this uptick in obesity. Number four, the poor are disproportionately affected. And they don't have access. They don't have access to good food. They don't have access to exercise because they're dodging bullets. Okay? Kids are not allowed out of the house for fear of crime, for fear they may get shot. If you don't have a choice, how is it personal responsibility? Because personal responsibility requires that you have a choice. You're responsible for your choice. But if you don't have a choice, it can't be personal responsibility, can it? Number five, the prevalence of obesity in children is going up faster than in adults. Now, you could make an argument that in adults it's personal responsibility, but do you really want to ascribe personal responsibility to toddlers? Is that what you want to do? You really want to say that the two-year-old is personally responsible for their weight gain? Because that's what's going on. And finally, as I mentioned before, we have an epidemic of obese six-month-olds, and they don't diet or exercise. So any hypothesis that attempts to try to explain the obesity epidemic has to explain this as well. And you can't, because it ain't true. I'll pass that. So the concept of personal responsibility, it's an ideology. There are four caveats to personal responsibility. First, you have to have knowledge. You have to know what you're doing. You have to be able to know what your choice was and what the consequences of your choice are. But what if you don't have the knowledge? Is it personal responsibility? So here are the 56 names for sugar on the food label. Read through them real quick. Did you know that those were sugar? Some of them, yeah, but did you know all of them? Did you know what panocha was? Did you know what treacle was? Well, you might know. I mean, that's British. But, you know, bottom line, there's a lot of these, and they use all of them. And the reason they use all of them is because they have to list ingredients by mass. So they can list a different kind of sugar as number 5, number 6, number 7, number 8, number 9. When you add them up, they're number 1. And you're not allowed to know, as an example. How about this? This is a standard nutrition facts label. You see where it's circled? Says sugars. Notice there is no dietary reference intake. There's no percent daily value. There's no upper limit. There's no way to know how much is too much. And that's on purpose. They don't want you to know. Because if you knew, breakfast cereal would disappear from the planet in a nanosecond. And I will show you that. Second, in order to exercise personal responsibility, you have to have access. You have to be able to access your choice. So what if you lived on the top of Love Canal and you knew that the water tables under your house were causing cancer in your family and everyone else in your neighborhood? But no one's going to buy your house because they know it too. And you can't afford to move because you got all your money tied up in your house. Is it personal responsibility that you're going to get cancer? Well, that's the same thing here. Same issue. If you don't have access, if you can't access your choice, the choice you'd like to make, how can it be personal responsibility? How about affordability? We have to be able to afford your choice. Individuals have to be able to afford their choice, and society has to be able to afford everyone's choice, which is not going on if insurers have to pay $2,750 for insurance, because that means that you are all paying higher premiums, so you can't afford it. And so maybe you don't have insurance. And finally, your choice can't hurt anyone else, because if your choice hurts someone else, that's called anarchy. That's breaking the law. That's what that is. Now, I'm a pediatrician. I do not believe that children are perpetrators. I have a hard time with that. I believe they're victims. And the reason I believe that is because I've watched it. I've seen it. And I'm going to show you a couple of patients right now that prove it to me. And hopefully it proves it to you. So this is how I got started in obesity research. This tumor right here, this Goomba with this arrow right here, in the middle of this patient's energy balance pathway. This is called a craniopharyngioma. And this patient required surgery and then radiation and then started gaining weight at the rate of 30 pounds per year nonstop because the area of the brain that controls energy balance was dead. This patient's brain thought he was starving all the time. All the time. Here's one patient with this problem. We put her on a drug that suppresses the hormone insulin because these kids release insulin like crazy because they're trying to store more energy because their brain thinks they need to because they think they're starving. Their brain thinks they're starving because that area of the brain is dead. So we put her on this drug called octreotide, and here she is 48 pounds later. No one had ever been able to get these kids to lose weight with this disorder. It's called hypothalamic obesity. Here's an example. Here's another example. So this is a girl who has the same issue, and there she is in the middle, having lost 4 BMI points, 24 pounds, in the span of 6 months. Well, the study was over, the drug ended, the insurance company wouldn't pay for it, and there she is desperately trying to lose weight in her swimming togs, and her BMI has blown up 10 BMI points. We finally did get her the drug, and her BMI went back down to 27. Do you really want to tell me this is this kid's fault? And how about this one? This kid here, 364 pounds, same thing, down to 326, first time he took a picture with his shirt off. And here's my favorite. This isn't even my patient. This is a beautiful young girl, 13 years old in this picture, from Hawaii. Notice the lily in her hair. And 1 month after this picture was taken, she was in a car accident on H1 in Honolulu. And she ended up in the Kaiser ER for a month unconscious, in a comatose. And when she woke up, she started gaining weight like crazy. And this is her 1 year later. Now, do you really want to tell me that this is personal responsibility? This is biochemical. Okay? Her brain is fried. That's what happened. She stroked her hypothalamus, that area of the brain that controls this. So this is what's going on. Anyway, I was giving grand rounds at Kaiser Honolulu, and the doctors there were thinking about putting this kid on the same drug, even though she didn't have a brain tumor. And so there I am with her and her mother, and they decided to go ahead and do it. And here she is a year and a half later at her high school graduation. Now, do you really want to tell me that this kid is guilty of gluttony and sloth? Are you really going to tell me that a calorie is a calorie? Are you really going to tell me that this is this kid's fault? Well, if it's not this kid's fault, then it's not anyone's fault. So let's rephrase the first law of thermodynamics to explain what's going on here. Remember how we phrased it before? If you eat it, you better burn it or you're going to store it, in which case the behaviors came first. Let's rephrase it. Let's do it this way. If you're going to store it, that is, an obligate weight gain set up by biochemical forces out of your control, for instance, a brain tumor, and you expect to burn it, that is, normal energy expenditure for normal quality of life, because energy expenditure and quality of life are synonymous, then you're going to have to eat it. And now, the two behaviors, the gluttony and the sloth, are secondary to the biochemical process, the weight gain, which is being driven by insulin in most cases. And that's what I do as an endocrinologist. That's my job. We have proven time and time again that when we alter the patient's biochemistry, the behavior fixes itself of its own volition. That the reason for the abnormal behavior is the biochemistry. That the biochemistry comes first. So the question is, okay, if the biochemistry comes first, why is everybody all biochemically out of whack? And how did that happen over the past 35 years? That's the nugget of what's going on in terms of this obesity crisis. So here's how you have to think about it. Here's a Venn diagram of the entire U.S. population. 30% obese, 70% normal weight. And the standard mantra, the standard thing that you will hear from most doctors, from the medical community, from the insurance community, from the Institute of Medicine, from the government, everybody, 80% of those obese people are metabolically ill. They get type 2 diabetes, they get cancer, they get dementia, they get lipid problems, they get heart disease, etc. Those 80% of 30%, those 57 million, they're the ones chewing us through house and home. They're the reasons that there's no money for anything else. They're the ones that are breaking the medical bank. And if they would only just exercise and diet, we could solve this problem. It's their fault. That's the standard mantra. Garbage. Ain't true. And here's why. Yeah, 80% of obese people are metabolically ill. That's true. They're sick. That means that 20% of obese people are not. They're metabolically healthy. They will live a completely normal life, die at a completely normal age, not cost the taxpayer a dime. They're just fat. Do they have a disease? Conversely, 40% of the normal weight population have the same metabolic dysfunctions as do the obese. They get type 2 diabetes. In fact, 40% of America today is pre-diabetic. Right now, today, people in this audience are pre-diabetic and you don't know it. Okay? They get heart disease, they get cancer, they get dementia, they get lipid problems. 40%. So when you do the math, it turns out there are more of them than there are the sick obese. And when you add the two together, it's more than half the U.S. population. Well, if normal weight people get it too, how can it be gluttony and sloth? If normal weight people get it too, it can't be a matter of energy balance anymore, can it? And therefore, it can't be personal responsibility either. Everybody see this? It's a problem. It doesn't work. This does not compute. So if normal weight people get it too, it can't be a behavior, can it? It's an exposure. The question is, what's the exposure? And that's where public health comes in, because that's what public health is for, is to deal with exposures. And I'll prove it to you. Here are two equally weighted people. One's healthy, one's sick. Want to tell me which one the sick one is, A or B? Why? Why B? Because why? Fat around the organs, right. The guy up on top, he's just got some big love handles, you know, something to hold on to. But the guy down below, he's got fat in his organs, and that's what makes him sick. Same weight. One healthy, one sick. Not okay. So there are people who are, you know, saying that fat person, it's their fault, they did it to themselves, they're costing me money. Well, guess what? That thin person probably is costing more money. That's not okay. Because the key to the kingdom is it's not about obesity. It never was. Never was. Food industry wants it to be about obesity because then they have a subterfuge because they can say, well, you could exercise it off. Or, why would you pick on our food when somebody else's food could do it too? Right? And everybody gets to choose what they put in their mouth. Three separate, easy things that just roll off the tongue that absolve corporations of their responsibility. But it's not about obesity. It's about the metabolic dysfunction, and anyone can get it. And when you fix the metabolic dysfunction, as we do in our clinic every day at UCSF, the weight comes down of its own volition. Fix the metabolic dysfunction, the obesity will improve, not the other way around. So what is going on? What changed? Well, what changed is something called processed food. That's the exposure. We are now all exposed to processed food because 80% of our food is now processed. Only 20% of our food is not. And many people have no exposure to even something that remotely looks like real food. So what is wrong with processed food? Eight things. Eight separate things are wrong with processed food. Here they are. Three things too little, five things too much. Not enough fiber. Fiber acts as a gel on the inside of your intestine, prevents absorption so that your liver doesn't get overloaded, because when your liver gets overloaded, that liver fat that we talked about, that's what causes the disease. Omega-3 fatty acids, this is what you get in wild fish. We don't get enough of them. Those stabilize neuronal membranes and prevent Alzheimer's and are anti-inflammatory. Micronutrients, which are necessary in order to detoxify various foodstuffs in the body, and that's what causes the non-alcoholic fatty liver diseases when you don't have enough of those. Too much, five things too much. Too much trans fats. Now, we know that. We know that we can't metabolize trans fats, and now they're going to come out of our food because finally the FDA agreed that trans fats were not generally recognized as safe. It took 25 years, but they finally said, okay, you're right. Branched-chain amino acids, leucine, isoleucine, valine. These are what you find in corn-fed beef, chicken, and fish. They go to the liver and get metabolized as liver fat as well. Omega-6 fatty acids, that's what you get in seed oils. That's what you get, you know, when in canola oil and what have you. Those are pro-inflammatory. Alcohol, but kids don't drink alcohol. And finally, the big one, the big kahuna, sugar. Sugar is a problem. Sugar is a problem not because of its calories. Sugar is a problem because it's sugar. In the same way, alcohol is not a problem because of its calories. Alcohol is a problem because it's alcohol. And sugar is metabolized in the liver the same way as alcohol and causes the same diseases. And if you look at kids now who get type 2 diabetes and fatty liver disease, these are the diseases of alcohol. Sugar is the alcohol of the child. And now children get alcoholic diseases, but they don't drink alcohol. So we have substances in our society that are addictive and hazardous to your health, like tobacco. What about this? What do you think? Could be? I'm not the only one who thinks so. Look at this. This is from the Vancouver province. Sugar, public enemy number one. I love this. Okay. So I'm going to talk to you very quickly about the information in these two articles that were written about our research from Gary Taubes, Is Sugar Toxic, on the left, from 2011, and our comment in Nature magazine called The Toxic Truth About Sugar on the right. So the question is this hyperbole? Am I going over the line? Am I overstepping my bounds? How could something that's natural, how could something that's ever-present be dangerous? What do you think? If it's in everything, there you go. Okay? You know, once upon a time, there was this thing called dessert. You know? And I like dessert. But you know what? I don't like dessert for breakfast. But that's what's in the National School Breakfast Program, because they're getting a bowl of Fruit Loops and a glass of orange juice. And that's 11 teaspoons of added sugar. And the American Heart Association says 4 for kids. That's the limit. So they're getting triple their dose, and it's just breakfast. So the question is that okay? So here's the definition of toxicity: the degree to which a substance can damage an organism. Now, it does not distinguish between acute versus chronic toxicity. It can be either. Now, in order for me to prove my point, I have to show that it's an independent risk factor, exclusive of its calories and exclusive of its effects on obesity. Otherwise, you could say, well, it's just the calories. And I have to establish causation. I can't just show correlation. I have to show causation, that it's proximate cause. Well, guess what? We have those data now. In the last 2 years, these data have now appeared. Now, the criticisms are, well, this is all animal studies, not human studies, and you have to give a whole lot to see this effect. So I'm going to limit the discussion to human data, human consumption only, and doses routinely used, so that it's not a question of excess. This is what people do. This is a study that just came out in February, which looks at the risk for cardiovascular death as a function of the percent of calories as added sugar in the diet. Now, the histogram in the back, in the gray, the median is at 18% of calories. But the inflection point on the hazard risk ratio in red is at 15%. In other words, more than half of the U.S. population has an increased risk of cardiovascular death due to their consumption of added sugar. And this is over a decade. And this factors out obesity, and it factors out energy intake, and it factors out a whole bunch of other things. This is causation. This is a study that was done in Europe called the EPIC Interact study. And what they did was they looked at what's your risk for diabetes based on how many cans of soda you drink per day. And if you drink a can of soda, exclusive of its calories and exclusive of its effect on weight, you have a 29% increased risk of developing diabetes because of that one soda per day. And we don't drink one soda, we drink 2.5. So up that to 68%. And that's actually very close to the data. The data says 75% for what we're doing today. And 9.3% of America has diabetes today because of this. We showed in a very complex and what's known as a econometric study that every 150 calories that the world eats, diabetes rates only go up 0.1%, which is nothing. But if those 150 calories happened to be a can of soda instead, the diabetes rates went up 11-fold. 11-fold higher for the same number of calories because they were sugar calories, not because they were calories. And we showed that dose matters, directionality matters, duration matters, and precedence, 3 years. Wherever sugar went up, diabetes came 3 years later. So you have to show that you have precedence in order to show cause. Well, we showed proximate cause for sugar and diabetes. Sugar causes diabetes. Take it to the bank. So, what does personal responsibility really mean? What does it really mean? If the information is kept secret and you don't know about it, if the access is limited because we have market saturation and it's in everything and you can't undo, if society can't afford it, and if your choice hurts others, which is what's going on right now, that's not freedom, that's anarchy. So the caveats to personal responsibility sink this all by itself. Plus, there are three inherent problems with the concept of personal responsibility. Number one, every personal health issue morphs into a public health crisis. Tobacco, alcohol, HIV, because they're exposures, not because of their behaviors. Number two, the cost is borne by all of society, not just the user. Everyone pays for the cocaine addict. Everyone pays for the heroin addict, right? Not them, everyone. So the concept that this is personal responsibility is garbage because we're paying for it. And number three, it absolves corporate responsibility. This is exactly what tobacco did to wangle free of culpability all those years, despite the fact that we got corporate malfeasance and they were targeting children. Are you okay with that? I'm not. And if you're okay with that, you know, you need to go live in Russia. Because that's what they do. So, here are a whole bunch of personal responsibility diseases. So you'd say syphilis is a personal responsibility disease because you can only get it from a behavior that you control, except it's not. It's a public health crisis. Okay? Same for all of these diseases, tuberculosis, foodborne illnesses, teen pregnancy, a personal responsibility disease, except it's a public health crisis. Pollution, guns, add sugar to the list because it's the same thing. It does the same issues. So what does the food industry do to try to keep us from understanding this? They do a bunch of things. They do seven things, to my understanding. The first is shoddy science. Let's show you some of the shoddy science. This comes from the World Sugar Research Organization, and they published this exactly 2 weeks ago. They said, sugar is less energy dense than fat. Therefore, it should help obesity. 4 calories versus 9 calories. So if you substitute sugar for fat, you will be eating fewer calories, except for one thing. It doesn't really work. Let's take a look at a cookie. Okay? So if you have a cookie that's a third fat and a third carbohydrate, then you have to put something in it before you bake it. It's called water. Okay? So that's a third water. So you get 39 calories out of that cookie over there. But you can actually substitute sugar for the water because it changes what's known as water activity. And that's what allows a cookie to be a cookie. And so now it's a third fat, a third carbohydrate, and a third sugar. So in fact, the caloric content of the cookie went up because you added the sugar, not because it's less dense than fat, because you can't cook a cookie without it. And how about snack wells? So 2 grams of fat down, 13 grams of carbohydrate up. That's 34 calories more. So, garbage. They also say in this same critique, the WHO consultation on obesity says that dietary fat has a higher energy density. This is thought to be largely responsible to the overeating effect, and therefore a reduction in sugar intake might lead to an increase rather than a decrease in the prevalence of obesity. Are you kidding me? Sugar causes insulin resistance at the level of the liver. That raises insulin levels all over the body. That causes more energy storage and tells your brain you're hungrier. The Atkins people prove this because they're consuming fewer calories. They actually lose weight. But they're eating all fat, and they become more insulin sensitive. And we didn't have a problem with obesity until sugar was added to the diet in the first place. So none of this makes sense. Buying scientists. This is my favorite. So who's the fourth most dangerous person of the 20th century? Anybody know? Frederick Stare. Frederick Stare, MD, PhD. So who is Frederick Stare? So he got his PhD at U of Wisconsin, his MD at U of Chicago. He is the founder of the Harvard School of Public Health Department of Nutrition. And he was the one who defined the four basic food groups. And he was the one who said, all things in moderation. And he came out against butter. And he said that all Americans should drink a cup of corn oil a day. He appeared in television advertisements for the corn oil producers. He took money from virtually every food industry and every tobacco industry there was. And I'm going to show you on the next slide the little back of the napkin thing that that his students put together. Okay? He extolled the virtues of sugar as a quick energy food, put a teaspoon in your coffee or tea 3 to 4 times a day. He wrote a treatise called Sugar in the Diet of Man, which was an 88-page white paper that exonerated sugar as a cause of any disease. It was funded by the sugar industry, but unfortunately, the volume neglected to mention it. And he was the primary subject of an expose called Professors on the Take back in 1976. Here's the back of the napkin evaluation. So you can see, here's Harvard over there, and there's the Continental Can Company, there's the Nutrition Department, and there's General Foods, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, Sugar Association, CPC International, Kellogg's, Nabisco, the Cereal Institute. They all gave money to the tune of $5 million in the first 5 years. Okay? And that's how the Harvard School of Public Health became the Harvard School of Public Health. How about this? This is my favorite. This comes from the Center for Consumer Freedom, right? The bad guys. So when sweet goes sour, you know there's a fight between the corn refiners and the Sugar Association right now for market share, and there's a lawsuit that's going on. So this was put out by the Center for Consumer Freedom to show what the Sugar Association was doing, all right? So here we go. This is what it says. So the Sugar Association's internal, external scientific advisory committee. The Sugar Association hired a company called the Academic Network. To organize an external scientific advisory committee to aid in these scientific endeavors, including differentiating fructose from sugar, the Academic Network's president explained that he could provide access to researchers who could influence health policy and consumer opinion. Who were those people? Well, turns out one of them is one of my colleagues in this field, whose name will remain nameless because I'm not interested in getting sued. But you can look this up online, by the way, if you really want to. SAI recognized that a review of fructose research would bolster their position. It worked with the academic network to provide grant money to Dr. X to write a review article. In the text of that, Dr. X wrote that it was supported by a grant from the academic network. But the academic network, meanwhile, indicates that it passed the grant money from the Sugar Association. In other words, they're laundering money through this academic network to buy off scientists. How about this? This came out a week ago in Diabetes Care. It's a debate between the pro and the anti-sugar people. So the anti-sugar people is George Bray and Barry Popkin. They said, health be damned, pour on the sugar. And then you got these other guys down here from Toronto who say, have we reached a crisis in the epidemic of obesity and diabetes? Yes, we have, but the pox on sugar is overwrought and overworked. Well, let's look at John Stephen Piper. He's my nemesis, so this is my chance to get back at him. Okay? He takes money from the Calorie Control Council, the Coca-Cola Company, Pulse Canada, International Treat Health Council, Nutrition Research and Education Foundation. And the duality of interest is listed there as well in orange. By the way, his wife is an employee of Unilever Canada. They are the ice cream people. So what's really interesting, remember those two studies I showed you, the EPIC Interact study and the other study that showed that sugar was the proximate cause of diabetes? He never mentions them. So this is brand new. And he doesn't mention the two studies that actually show causation. He doesn't mention them at all. Why do you think that is? It's very difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. Upton Sinclair said that. Remember the author of The Jungle? Okay? Indeed, this is exactly right. Third, co-opting critics. Here's one set of critics that have been co-opted. Anybody ever heard of the AND? Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. They used to be the American Dietetic Association. They've changed their name. This is called, and now a word from our sponsors, and this is from Michelle Simon, who is one of our colleagues, who's a public health lawyer and runs Eat Drink Politics. And it says, are America's nutrition professionals in the pocket of big food? So much so that a splinter group has now formed called Dietitians for Professional Integrity that don't take money. They don't take money. So there are dietitians out there who are clean, but most of them take money. How about this? This is, I was at this meeting, and I was going to show this slide at the American Academy of Pediatrics in Washington, D.C., and they told me if I went on the stage, if I went on the dais, I had to take this slide out of my slide deck. So I'm showing it to you now. How about the American Academy of Family Physicians? They launched a consumer alliance with Coca-Cola to the tune of $1 million. And finally, how about Congress? Sugar protections prove easy to swallow for lawmakers across the political spectrum. Everyone's making money off this. Weakening government oversight. This is my favorite. This is from the Federal Trade Commission. Anybody ever heard of them? They used to be powerful. And they actually put sugar in its place back in 1972 for advertisements like this. Sugar's quick energy can be the willpower you need to eat less. The fat time of day, you're really hungry and ready for two of everything. Here's how sugar can help. Sugar might just be the willpower you need to curb your appetite. Sugar can be the willpower you need to undereat. Now, there was no data to support this whatsoever. But they were allowed to do this. Well, the FTC actually sanctioned them, and they went away, the sugar information, which was great. But then they got declawed by the Kidvid debacle. So they tried to get marketing to children removed from television ads, and the food industry went berserk, absolutely berserk. And this ignited a huge political regulatory firestorm, and it ended up with the FTC being declawed by Congress in 1981. And you have never heard from the FTC since. Because the one group that could actually stop this kind of bad behavior on the part of corporations can't because of Congress. How about voluntary restrictions? So in Istanbul in 2007, 52 European health ministers voted to cease marketing of junk foods to children. I asked the Federal Communications Commissioner under George W. Bush, Deborah Taylor Tate, about this to her face, and this is what she said. I expect the food industry to police itself. That's her response. So in Santa Clara and here in San Francisco, we instituted a toy ban on Happy Meals. After that happened, 3 states passed bans on toy bans. This is a slide that I love. This came from this new thing from the Union of Concerned Scientists. These are the political contributions to Blanche Lincoln, who is the chairman of the Senate Committee on Agriculture. And you'll notice that the 2 years are the years of her reelection, 2004-2010. Okay? They're buying our representatives. Market saturation. I love this. Sugar Smack. I did this one. Here are the 10 worst children's cereals. 17 children's cereals have more than 50% sugar today. 17. And 188 children's cereals, all of them have added sugar. There's not one children's cereal that's marketed for children that doesn't have added sugar. They're all tainted. They're all a problem. That's why children's cereals have to disappear. Where is the sugar? Well, a third of it's in beverages, so people, you know, focused on that, like, you know, for instance, the soda tax business and all that. A third of it's in desserts, but a half of it is hidden in foods you didn't know had it. Like, for instance, salad dressing, yogurt, barbecue sauce, tomato sauce, ketchup, all sorts of crackers, et cetera. All throughout the diet, and that's the problem. So even if we cut back on sodas and juices, we'd still be over our limit. And they've even saturated us, because here's Ronald McDonald Children's Hospital at Loyola. This is from a cafeteria in an American Children's Hospital in Fort Worth, Sir Eats-a-Lot Grill. You think that's a good idea to have in a children's hospital cafeteria? AstroTurf groups. Everybody knows what AstroTurf groups are? They're supposed to be grassroots organizations, except they're not. Okay. How about this one? This one's my favorite. Citizens for Health. It's a nonprofit, but it's funded by the Sugar Association specifically to take down high fructose corn syrup. And it's run by a guy by the name of George Turner, who is the special counsel to Senate Select Committee on Food, Nutrition, and Health and the Senate Government Operations Committee on Government Research. He is a high-powered Washington lawyer. This is a grassroots group, by definition, right? And finally, marketing to children. So we have all of these Supreme Court decisions that now allow marketing to children, like Virginia State Pharmacy Board, Central Hudson. Here's what you have to do to stop commercial speech. You have to show that it is directly and materially advances a substantial government interest that is narrowly tailored to reasonably fit that interest. Nothing does that. You have to do all four of them, and there's nothing that anyone can do that will show all four of them. The substantial government interest is easy. It's the rest of them. You can't do it. And that's why commercial speech is unfettered. And that's why you get this. Joe Camel, Ronald McDonald, SpongeBob, Hot Wheels, M&Ms. I love this one. Drinks are on us. Publix. Remember the supermarket Publix down in Florida? Publix is rewarding top grades with free apple juice and soda. Students, we salute your thirst for knowledge. This is a great way to get Alzheimer's, is what this is. Soft drink logos on baby bottles. The birth of the Uncola. Why we have the youngest customers in the business. You okay with this? It's a global marketing campaign. There's McDonald's, there's Coke, Oreos, and the effect is global too. I mean, you know. So the question is, this is a war. Okay? You're in a war and you don't even know you're fighting. Okay? Because they want your money. They want your money and they're really good at getting it. So who's winning the war? Well, here's the economic downturn of 2008. You see the downturn over there? And there's the stock price of McDonald's, Coke, and Pepsi against the S&P 500. And here's Monsanto, Hormel, General Mills, Procter & Gamble, ConAgra, Kraft, and ADM, all against the S&P. Want to make money? Invest in a food company. At the American Heart Association, we know that this is a problem, and we've said so. And I was part of the co-authorship committee on this, and I'm very proud of it. This is a paper that came out just a year ago that says that we, in the medicine, used to practice the old medicine, which was about infections, and the vector were microbes. But the new medicine is now about chronic disease, non-communicable disease, and the vector is multinational corporations. And you know how bacteria develop resistance? They learn about their environment. Well, multinational corporations do the same. And so they battle us at every step. So the homework assignment for all of you, the thing to think about, can our toxic food environment be changed without government or societal intervention, especially if there are potentially addictive substances involved? Question 2, can we afford to wait to enact these measures when healthcare will be bankrupt due to chronic metabolic disease. And I will tell you right now, if Medicare ain't around in 2026, I'm blowing something up. And so should you. And number three, can six-month-old obese babies change the medical profession or the food industry or Washington? If they can't, I don't know what can. So I'm going to just pass through. I'm just going to mention there are things that we can do to advance the public health. One's public education. Look at this. Here's an NBC Wall Street News Journal poll looking at what Americans think is the most dangerous substance. So, of course, cigarettes, 50%. Alcohol, 27%. Notice, sugar, more dangerous than marijuana. So people are starting to get the picture that there's a problem here. 15% of Americans think sugar is the most dangerous substance in America today. That's pretty cool. If a researcher isn't willing to follow his data into the policy arena, who will? This is a statement by Jeremiah Stamler, the father of cardiovascular epidemiology, and it's the reason I'm standing up here today. Because the data tell me what I need to do. And it ought to tell you what you need to do. And academics are now picking up where politicians won't. So in the UK, there's a group called Action on Sugar. And just this morning, they put enough public shaming and enough public pressure on their Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee. And they came out with an upper limit for sugar of 5% of calories. Just like what the World Health Organization agreed to, which was a huge, huge win, and we are very proud of them. In Australia, they've got Fighting Sugar and Soft Drinks. In the Netherlands, they've got a group called Fooding Lift, Food Lives, all in cahoots with us. We're part of that. And here in San Francisco, we've started this nonprofit called the Institute for Responsible Nutrition, responsiblefoods.org. Wolfram is right there. You can talk with him after the talk is over. For further reading, these guys, business. Business is going to solve this problem for us. You know why? Because this is hurting productivity. So anybody see this report? You can get it online. It's called Sugar Consumption at a Crossroads, written by Credit Suisse, an international investment bank. And do you know what they say on page 26? We believe higher taxation on sugary food and drinks would be the best option to reduce sugar intake and help fund the fast-growing healthcare costs associated with type 2 diabetes and obesity. This is an international investment bank calling for sugar taxation. Who'd have thunk it? Okay? Because this has gotten so big and so bad, this is now affecting their bottom line. And they're going to put pressure on the food industry. And the insurers are going to put pressure on the food industry. And the word on Wall Street's out, because big sugar's taking a beating. Remember I showed you all those stock prices? Well, take a look at Ilovo, Sudzucker, and Tate & Lyle against the S&P. Not doing so hot these last 2 years. How about that? And here's Pepsi, Dr. Pepper Snapple, and Coke. And they're finally below the S&P for the first time because people are getting wind. Public education is starting to work. We are now in the midst of the revolution that had been stifled for the past 30 years, that those 1980s, all those changes that we talked about at the beginning, we're going to take back America. And that's why I felt it was so important to talk about that here with you today. The insurance industry did this with seatbelts. It was in their best interest because they were paying out money. Well, it's in their interest to rein in big food as well. Government agency action. Here's the old label. Here's the new label. The only thing that's different, added sugars at the bottom, but there still won't be an upper limit, and that's a problem, and we need to work on that. I'm going to pass on that. And then finally, legal recourse. Litigation, regulation through litigation. You all heard that the Bloomberg Big Gulp ban got struck down again yesterday, and the response of the Supreme Court justice was, what, are we going to stop, we're going to ban triple burgers as well? Because they think a calorie is a calorie. That's the problem. They still think a calorie is a calorie. We have to make it very clear that this is a problem exclusive of calories. This is why I went to law school. I just got a master's in studies of law. This statement right here, all significant advances in population health require and involve the use of law. That's exactly right. And it goes back 100 years in America to this Supreme Court decision called Jacobson v. Massachusetts, where a Swedish pastor said he was not going to get vaccinated for smallpox, and the Supreme Court said, yes, you are, or pay a fine. It wasn't a big fine, but it was a fine. The problem is that there has been slow erosion of this ruling over time because of special interests. Bottom line is, our government is supposed to protect us, and right now they're not. And we have to take it back. I'll pass on this just for time. The conclusions. The food industry has adulterated our food supply for profit. This is a public health crisis because it's an exposure, not a behavior. The industry has bought off scientists and co-opted critics routinely. Most of the checks and balances have been systematically eroded because of all of these Supreme Court decisions. Government's been complacent and in some cases complicit because they're making money off it also. $56 billion in export tariffs for processed food going to other countries. The problem is we're paying, you know, 10 times as much in Medicare and Medicaid costs. Our best chances are public education, business action, and legal action. But in order to do those things, we have to understand what we're doing. That's my job, and I hope now you understand, and I hope it will become your job as well. With that, I want to thank my collaborators at UCSF, many of whom are in the room right now, and I want to just open the floor to questions if we have time. Thank you so much for your attention.
I'm going to end the program, but we're going to still answer the questions, but just because of time and what we need to do. So, anyway, closing. Okay, here we are. Our thanks to Dr. Robert Lustig for their comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 111th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.